Jonathan Scott Fuqua, welcome back to The Signal and congratulations on this new book.
Thank you so much for having me. It's nice to be back.
The Secrets of the Greaser Hotel. This is a fantastic sort of fever dream of a story. It's part fairy tale. It's part mystery thriller. It's part superhero story, even part socioeconomic critique. We'll get into that in a little bit. But it all starts with a teenage girl named Allie who is stuck somewhere really unpleasant. And I wonder if you might just kick us off here by reading the first page or so of your book, which kind of sets the scene for us.
Absolutely. Let me begin here. The immense Greaser Hotel was located amidst the once famous and now bankrupt department stores and theaters of downtown Baltimore. A monstrous hulk of brick and stone covering an entire block, the Greaser was plastered with a hodgepodge of architectural details, pieces of which had been coming off in flakes and chunks for the last two decades. For fear of getting struck dead by a plummeting Italianate bracket or medieval gargoyle, pedestrians strictly avoided using the sidewalks adjacent to the Greaser, a fact that suited the caretakers just fine. Opened by the mysterious Marvin Greaser in 1880, the once posh hotel was leased to the city 75 years later. Thereafter, for three decades, it served as public housing, after which time, and due to the fact that it was considered unfit for human habitation, the lease expired and the building became a chemical warehouse for Greaser Consolidated Enterprises, until the day a nosy fire inspector, now deceased, pronounced the facility a terrible fire hazard. Following that, the old hotel was emptied of chemicals and assigned an on-site property manager. Greasy blight, which is what the building was called by locals, was a stain on an already stained landscape of failed Baltimore businesses. It was a monument to a once prosperous Baltimore. Most every resident of the city wanted it torn down, presuming it abandoned and an obstruction to downtown redevelopment. But the building wasn't vacant at all. It was occupied by the wicked, unlikable Friendly family, a clan consisting of a wildly tough mother and her five adult boys, a young girl named Allie Argos, as well as three other forlorn and desperate individuals also inhabited the building, but they weren't there by choice.
They weren't there by choice. Jonathan Scott Fuqua reading from the opening pages of his new book, The Secrets of the Greaser Hotel. And Scott, tell us a little bit more about this girl, Allie, our protagonist, who she is, what she does and doesn't understand about her situation, and you know, what she comes up against as this story unfolds.
In this story, it's funny. There are a lot of people in the Greaser Hotel who deserve to be there. There are people who have done all sorts of nasty things. Allie is not one of them. She's the most innocent individual in the hotel. And what she experiences over time is this kind of growing understanding that it's unfair for her to be there, that she is being mistreated. And the person who's kind of helping her with this knowledge or imparting this knowledge on her is a...
Not a person at all.
Is not a person at all. It's a cat. A cat who has been visiting her for many years. A cat who has become not unlike a father to her and speaks to her when she's feeling bad, speaks to her when she's feeling happy, gets her through her days of drudgery. And that's kind of how the whole thing begins. I mean, Allie is just an innocent amongst what you would call wolves.
Yeah, and so she and these other sort of captives in the Greaser Hotel, they basically slave away, a la Cinderella, cleaning and cooking for this wicked sort of horror movie family, the Friendlies, ironically named the Friendlies. You mentioned this cat named Jerome, who's this this wise soul in the body of a cat. This story, it does what I think young adult books do best, and most controversially, and that is to present young readers with a way to access some really heavy grown-up world themes. I mean, on one level, this book is about a girl with an undiscovered superpower. It's about a talking cat, these fairy tale things, but it's also about some truly dark, real-world ugliness. Let me have you talk about some of the difficult themes lurking in the shadows of this story.
Well, if I were to pinpoint one thing this story is about, I would say it's about greed. If you look at what Allie experiences, her superpower, if you want to call it that, that she kind of slowly learns or discovers about herself, it's basically based on greed and narcissism. The more greed or narcissism or anger or self-preservation sensation she has, the stronger she gets. And I think that's kind of a metaphor for individuals who watch out for themselves. The more you watch out for yourself, the easier things get. The more you watch out for yourself, you know, it's pretty easy to step on somebody else to rise above. What I'm trying to say with Allie is that she's wrestling with this. She doesn't agree with it. And the people around her, like Jerome, are telling her, you know, look, what you're thinking, what you're feeling, these things are not necessarily good things. And you've got to come to terms with them. So the book is about this overwhelming sense for greed and self-preservation, not necessarily in Allie's case. Allie experiences it in these singular moments, but everyone else around her is watching out for themselves in every way or shape possible. Mrs. Friendly, you know, she's absolutely making sure that she survives and prospers.
She's the evil matron in the Greaser Hotel.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then you have the more evil individuals. You have Marvin Greaser and Herman Grissel. Marvin Greaser is the puppet master of this whole thing. And you begin to learn about Marvin Greaser as the story goes by, that Marvin has his fingers in everything.
Greaser and Grissel are these two sort of corrupt corporate bosses.
And somehow related. In the end, what you begin to realize is that everything is intertwined. And the one motivating factor for all of it is that these people all want what they want. Then they want to be boss, they want to be in control, and they want to have everything. The only individual who doesn't, seemingly, is Allie, and of course, the faithful cat.
What we see also is the flip side of this desire for power, which is the damage that greed can do to the people who are exploited. I mean, your book, frankly, confronts things like post-traumatic stress syndrome, Stockholm syndrome, cult deprogramming. I mean, there is serious psychological work to be done for someone who's, you know, been at the mercy of these unscrupulous people for so long.
Well, I think when I wrote about some of those things in the book, I think my editor was taken aback momentarily. They said, wow, you know, that's kind of a heavy issue. And it is a heavy issue. But realistically, we experience, you know, post-traumatic stress from much lesser things. I mean, this individual lives in a circumstance that is less than third world. And she does leave it scarred. And she carries those scars with her. And it's, you know, up to Jerome and another gentleman later introduced to the story to kind of help her through some of that. But she's only in the early stages and she's wrestling with, you know, do I throw all this away and just watch out for myself? What do I do? It's a tough lot that she has and it's an unsure future for her.
Jonathan Scott Fuqua is the author of 16 books for children and young adults. Is that right, Scott? 16?
Yes.
Unbelievable. His most recent is The Secrets of the Greaser Hotel. He's also, I should say, an artist, and he's illustrated several of his books as well, including this one. And Scott, the images in this book, they're on like every other page or so, tucked in corners or in between paragraphs, these little half-page images, black and white pencil drawings, it looks like. What was your inspiration for including these?
Well, you know, it's funny. I teach at MICA, the Maryland Institute College of Art. And when I'm there, I kind of often teach a course called narrative illustration. And what I like to do in that class is talk to people about how you include image in your writing. And image can help tell a story as well as, you know, more words or anything like that. I mean, it's vital to the process if used correctly. So I wanted to see what it would look like in a traditional novel format. Not only that, you know, this new generation of kids that we have kind of coming out, these kids who have kind of grown up on computer screens and computer games and those sort of things, they're incredibly visual. So when I put these in there, I give a lot of hints to what the story is about, what's going to take place next, what might have just taken place, and other aspects of the story in these illustrations. You just have to look more deeply into them. But it's kind of a test run for me. I'm very curious to see how something with 110 illustrations, a traditional story, works with young people. And it's my guess that if anything throws in, it'll be the black and white. But I think they'll really embrace something like this. I think it's a given.
The images are black and white. They are really well detailed and rendered and textured and just about as creepy as the story. you mentioned they're in black and white, which I suppose is convenient for you, as I understand you are colorblind.
Yes, I am colorblind. I am colorblind.
But you work in color in other books you've done and at your teaching at MICA.
Right. I do work in color all the time. It has yet to really bother me. It is funny because the cover and the interior, everything else about the book is in full color, and I did all of that. But I am colorblind, and it is funny that that I wrestle with that almost on a daily basis, meaning sometimes I'll be applying color to a lot of the projects I'm working on and really not know the color I'm putting down. Just assume that if I put the right hue down, the right heat down, whether it be hot or cold or anything like that, the right temperature, that I'll get it right. And I usually always do, but every so often I'll be standing next to a student and they'll say, "Did you really want to put green there?" And I'll look at her and I'll say, "Yes, of course I did."
Then you'll quietly go and change it after the student leaves.
I always change it, yes.
Now, on top of the colorblindness, I hope you don't mind me mentioning this and pursuing it, but you're dyslexic as well.
I am dyslexic,
so yes. This is quite a 1-2 punch to be an author and an illustrator who is dyslexic and colorblind.
Yeah, you know, and it used to really seem like a big issue. Like, I used to hide from these kind of things. Like, the last thing I want everyone to know is that I am both dyslexic and colorblind. But I've realized that so many creative people are dyslexic, and a lot of writers are dyslexic. It's not that absurd, you know, though it sounds it at first. You know, dyslexia actually helped me become a better writer in that I would often, as a young boy, be scared to use larger words, sure that I'd misspell them, and I surely would have. And I'd write something in a metaphor. I'd write a larger word as metaphor. And my teachers used to always praise me. "Boy, you write such beautiful metaphors." And I'd be like, "I couldn't spell it, but thank you so much."
You must rely a lot on the careful hand of an editor then, when it goes between manuscript and final book.
I do, in fact. You know, I simply can't find all the words. I am that dyslexic. I cannot find every word that's incorrectly spelled or the word jumbles that I create too, that I read as perfect. I can't find them, but I do rely on an editor and I rely on a computer, and I see that I'm not a techno hound. I don't love technology necessarily. At the same time, I do appreciate it an awful lot. It really helps me do my work.
That being said, I mean, what compels you to follow this path? I mean, the path most directly correlated with your hurdles.
Well, you know, I always loved to draw. It is very funny. When I was a kid and I couldn't kind of get across an idea or I wanted to emphasize an idea, I would draw it about 1,000 times, which would irritate my parents to no end, but would get the point across. So one day I'd get home and I'd have a bunny, you know, or something like that. So I began to see that you could say an awful lot with visuals. In regards to writing, you know, it wasn't so much the writing that I loved as the story and the sound of people telling stories. So it was kind of the oral tradition that I really loved, and I wanted to capture that and put it on a page. And so if you read my stuff, it's very lyrical for that specific reason. I want it to sound as if it's almost poetically told by a really wonderful speaker like you.
You trying to give me a job reading your audiobook version of this thing?
Please, please.
No, it is not. I guess the nice thing about young adult books and children's books is that they get read aloud more often than, you know, grown-up fiction, right? You're reading them to somebody else, and that really is an important consideration, the way the words sound when you're putting them on the page.
Oh, boy. To me, I mean, the way the words sound is so important, and, you know, I just love the entire feel. As for, you know, the difference between a young adult book and, you know, that minor difference of reading it aloud, it's huge to me. And the other big difference is, you know, I usually see kids with my books and they're just tattered and torn. They've been gone over, loaned. It's just fantastic. I mean, you never see that with an adult book. So there's so many things about that specific kind of type of writing that's just, you know, it's wonderful.
Do you have a certain kind of kid or a certain particular kid in mind when you're maybe when you wrote this book, The Secrets of the Greaser Hotel? Did you write it for a certain kind of kid?
You know, I think I wrote it for a kid who was probably 12, 13, or 14 and was looking around and feeling like everything is falling apart. And it might not show at the end of this book, but I think you get a glimmer of it. To me, there is hope, and I always want to impart hope. And so hopefully a child could open this up and see that, you know, good does, in the end, survive. And I think that's what I wanted to do. So I see it as a kid who, you know, is struggling. My reader is a kid who's struggling, and yet will take something from this that will help him struggle less.
I don't want to give too much away about the secrets of the Greaser Hotel, but there is a point in this story when our protagonist, Allie, kind of discovers the full potential of a certain paranormal power that she's didn't really know she possessed. And at this moment, she almost loses her mind with revenge or rage or, as you write in the book, hatred. And this is a very sort of Stephen King type moment.
Yeah.
I wonder if you might talk about what's going on in her at this moment and maybe what you want readers to struggle with too.
Well, I think we've all been mistreated enough to kind of just imagine taking out revenge upon someone or something. We see it to varying degrees, meaning, you know, some really nice people imagine just, you know, having the perfect comeback, and other people see it much grander than that. I've lived a unique life. I've had a lot of experiences in a pretty tough childhood, and I just remember visioning these kind of things and the catharsis of visioning it. Now, I could never do it, obviously, but it is all about getting that deep, horrible emotion out. And as she does expel it all, there's a certain degree of exhaustion that comes over her because it does just come out. It empties her. And, you know, what do I want kids to take from it? I think what I want them to take from it is that to some extent, we all need to be in control. And that moment that she is out of control is not very pretty. And in fact, she is awfully close to being lost.
There is hope at the end of this book, as you say, after the storm that precedes it. I must say also at the end of this book, there is the distinct feeling that a sequel must be in the works because there are a lot of unanswered questions. You know this. Will Allie discover the origins of her strange powers? Will she be able to harness the dark emotions and use them for good? Will her enemies reemerge to continue to pursue her? Audiences want to know, Mr. Fuqua.
Yes. Well, it is funny. You know, I would have loved to have brought in here the beginning of the next chapter, which is absolutely fantastic and off the wall. And I can tell you this, it begins in Oklahoma and in a gun shop in Oklahoma, and it ends in Baltimore here again. So it is exciting. Yes, there'll be a second book, and I can't wait to really get on it.
As they say, to be continued. The Secrets of the Greaser Hotel, the name of the book. It's published by Bancroft Press. Jonathan Scott Fuqua is the author and illustrator. And Scott, thank you very much.
Aaron, thank you for having me.